PPI.org.
KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. This is Disability and Progress. We bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Good evening, Charlene.
Good evening. Sorry about the clock.
Mason Engineers, thank you for engineering, Mason. Tonight, we have an author in our midst. We have Bruce Ariel. Bruce is a author of the book most recently called Changing Ways. Good evening, or hello, Bruce.
Hello, Sam.
You know, anybody who knows, who is a longtime listener knows that this show generally airs on the evening. So when I slip and say good evening, that is why. But we are doing podcasts now until things return back to a little bit of normality. So that means it could be anytime you're listening to this. By the way, a reminder, if people want to be on my email list to find out what's coming up, they can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. If you have a suggestion or think you know of a topic that should be discussed, we welcome that as well. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. We're speaking with Bruce. And Bruce, can you give me a little bit of history about you and how you had the idea of becoming an author?
Well, it kind of unfolded back in the mid-80s. I had been in law school, had 2 years completed, and then because of a mental illness, found it impossible to continue in that. And so I became homeless. And when I was out on the streets as a homeless person, another homeless man came up to me, an elderly man. And he found out I had been in law school and he was kind of wondering what the heck happened to me. And he asked me, he said, "Say, what do you want to do with the rest of your life?" And I started to tell him and he put his hands up to his lips and said, "Shh, write it on a piece of paper." And so I wrote down, I wanted to be a writer. Uh-huh. And kind of a glow came over him, and he said, "Then go do it." And then I was in a halfway house shortly after that, and she said, "What do you want to do with the rest of your life?" And my psychologist, and I said, "Joan, I got to go back to law school, complete that." And she said, "Besides that, Bruce, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I decided to go for it because writing is kind of a hard profession to really get into because you know you're not going to be making money and you know it's going to be a hard, long road." But that's what I chose. I said, "Joan, I got to be a writer then." And she said, "Write me a poem." And I wrote her a poem and she liked it. And things have just snowballed down the mountain since then.
And how many books to date have you written so far?
Well, I've written 4 books, 4 novels, and I have about 5 or 6 collections of poetry on Kindle. But I have 4 paperback books that I have published.
Excellent. You know, going back to when you discovered you had a mental illness, you know, what is it? Is it 1 in 5 people that have a mental illness?
Something like that. Yeah.
Can you talk about when you first discovered that you did have a mental illness and how it happened that, how did it lead to your diagnosis? What happened?
Well, I was in a car accident and I hit my head on the windshield. And the very next day I was feeling kind of nauseous and estranged from people. And I remember hearing my roommates out in the living room when I was in my bedroom, and I was saying, I don't want to talk to them. I'm somehow different now. And and so I hung in there for about 9 months, and then I had a psychotic break. Aww. I snapped, yeah.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stand the pressure. And then I was turned myself into a psych ward with my parents' guidance. And the doctor saw me, and after about 2 minutes, he said, "You're schizophrenic." And that kind of stuck. Doctors, once they make that decision, don't want to change because they feel you're unstable anyway, and they want to be the pillar of strength. But I think I was misdiagnosed. I think I had a traumatic brain injury.
Right.
And, but that's how it happened. It's called schizophrenic.
So is it really that now, or did you come to, is it something different?
Well, no, it's still schizophrenia. That's what I'm being treated for. There was an angel involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a vision of an angel, which I believe was real. I'm a Christian, and it seemed very, very real to me. I could really, really distinguish a voice out there that was over me and kind of guiding me. And when the doctors heard about the angel,
these
scientists thought it was delusion.
Gotcha.
They thought it was delusion. That's why they called me schizophrenic. And they still to this day, my doctor still is a scientist, and he does not really have time for God. Mm-hmm. And so he doesn't really understand the things that I say. So he still thinks I'm schizophrenic. And truthfully, my mind can go off. I have to be careful because my mind can go off. And I did have a severe problem with mental illness, but I think it was because of the car accident. But he thinks it's schizophrenia, and I just don't want to go off again. It was too hard to come back from that.
Right. The mental illness clearly came before you were an author.
Yes.
Was it easy for you to transfer your knowledge over to paper and write about, you know, your experiences? How did that work?
I wanted to. Bob Dylan was once asked, "Why do you write all these things?" He goes, "It just comes to me." And that's how it was for me. I just had to talk about it. I just felt this burning desire to talk about it. And people would say, "Why are you telling me this?" And I would just kind of be dumbfounded, knowing that I needed to talk. And you know, it wasn't really particularly easy because I wrote about some things that were embarrassing, even incriminating.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't easy to do. But in the spirit of artistry, I wanted to be truthful. And so I was. And it wasn't really easy, but It just came to me. I just put on paper what came to me without thinking too much, especially my first book, City Boy.
Yes, which we had you on then.
That's right.
We go way back.
We do, Sam. We do.
So it was funny. We were talking before the show, and we were talking about holidays. And actually, holidays is very common that it's a lonely time. I don't think it's just lonely for people with mental illness. I know people who are, you know, they're just alone, and it can be lonely for them too. But for mentally ill people, it can be very difficult to manage. And so I'm wondering have you ever been lonely during the holidays? And if so, how did you deal with that? Or how do you deal with that if that still is the case?
Well, Sam, ever since that angel visited me, I've never been lonely.
Aww.
I always have God in my life. That's why I think it's bona fide, is because she led me in a direction of more. She kept giving me more and more, and that's always how it's been. And I've never been without. Even when I was homeless, I was not really, really without. I mm-hmm. always had hope. I always had a vision. I always had something good in my life. So I have not experienced what a lot of people experience, that pang of loneliness. I just, either I don't allow myself to get lonely, or I really am not lonely, which I think is the case. I'm really not lonely.
Right.
And I do have a friend now that we talk a lot on the phone, and she's a great joy of my life. And so I'm not lonely, but I know there are people that are.
And I wonder, it's interesting because you talk about you don't allow yourself to get lonely. And I think of that sometimes when I think of, I don't allow myself to get lazy, or I don't allow myself to get, you know, fill in the blank. But it's more than just that, right?
It's more than that, yeah.
I think sometimes you have to have a purpose or a feeling that you have something to turn to. I'm not sure if it needs to be religious, but I think it has to be something that fills you. And what's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's exactly what I think. And, no, it'd be pretty hard for me to say that my vocation really serves a great purpose, but I have been able, you got to kind of either fool yourself a little bit or really summon up all your abilities to think that, you know, a blue collar job can be purposeful, but it really can be. You know, I'm a cog in the wheel. I keep the wheel moving. We keep the mail moving. That's my sense of purpose. And I always believe, because the angel visited me, that God has a purpose for me. I've been blessed that way. I always felt that there was purpose. My dad was a philosopher. He talked about the meaning in life, and he was very encouraging about having a purpose in life. So I've kind of, you know, become comfortable and hung on to the fact that there is a purpose in my life. It's not meaningless to me, which I think is one of the hardest things, that people think their life is meaningless.
Yes, I think you're right. I would like to talk about your latest book, Changing Ways,
sure.
And which features characters living with mental illness. Talk a little bit about what that's about.
Well, Changing Ways is about a young girl that's quite rebellious with her father. She's kind of upset that she's got a mental illness, but doesn't really throw up her hands, and says she gets rebellious and goes for her father's drug dealer, trying to really search, I think, for his love. And she tests him a lot, and no, she thinks she sees light at the end of the tunnel, because I gave her a vision kind of the same way I had one. And she's got an angel in her life. So she sees light at the end of the tunnel, but she doesn't know how to get there. She thinks it's through her father. Mm-hmm. And so she becomes really rebellious, and he's kind of uncomfortable because she's really going for his throat. And he's trying to maintain, because he's a judge in the Manhattan Mental Health Court, and he's got to keep his job in line. And she's really trying him now. That kind of parallels a little bit with me in my life. I was rebellious against my parents, and I thought that my salvation came through them. And it turns out, in a large sense, it has. That rebellion, you know, is probably necessary for a lot of people to go through in order to find really peace of mind. And I think it's like just staking your territories, finding your wings, finding your direction in life. You got to rebel a little bit and almost cast off other people's expectations of you. And, what society demands of you. I mean, you can't go well violating the laws, which I did a little bit, but you really can't do that, because that will require you to pay a price. And But you can rebel. You can just say, it's my life. I'm the one that has to live it, so I'm the one in the driver's seat. And that's what the young girl was really trying to do, I think. Well, that's kind of what my my ambitions for her were. And in the end, she kind of is able to do that.
You know, writing about a mental illness, when you have one, I would think could be very personal. I'm wondering, how much do you share about yourself in your writings?
Well, I write fiction now. There's a reason for that. It's like the story I had from my own life in my head was just too tragic. This has it really happened to me, and how I would really was too tragic for anybody to really and see much value in or much interest. The doctors try that, they call you mentally ill and they try to understand your delusions and your problems, but it was too tragic for me. So I kind of took a leap and said, you know, my life is great. And I've been saved through Christianity. And then the stuff that happened to me in the past, I'm not going to deal with. I'm going to create my own reality. And so that's what I do in my novels, is just kind of create my own reality. I realize I got to stay in touch with other people. Mm-hmm. And I can't just, but a lot of the great artists took that leap where they just said, I'm going to write fiction. I'm going to create almost a make-believe life that's based, that gets its ideas from reality, but creates a world of imagination. And that's what I don't wonder if Christ did that himself with the kingdom of God. You know, I'm quite proud of being an artist creating this reality.
And I would think, you know, one of the issues that what one could have is, you know, one of the things you do discuss in your book is boundaries. Right. And I would think you as an artist need to set boundaries, that it would be important to keep a boundary between you and your writing, excuse me. And yes. Is that, at least your personal life and your writing, is that something that's hard to do?
Well, yeah, it has been for me, truthfully. I probably could say I've had boundaries. I told my most personal life in City Boy, and a lot of artists would not do that. A lot of people would just not do that. They save that for their close friend or lover, and that's about it. But I told the world kind of my vulnerabilities. So it was an issue with me. That, in the doctor's mind, that's where they've been helpful. They say that's not right. That's kind of mental illness to want to do that. And in some sense, I kind of agree with them. I just wanted to do it because I felt maybe I could help somebody avoid the mistakes I made.
Do you ever regret kind of letting that guard down and breaching that boundary, so to speak?
Well, it meant that I didn't have a family. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of women would have been kind of, I had a girlfriend and she seemed to handle it okay, but she kept encouraging me to shut up and not tell everybody everything, you know? Yeah. And so I think it would have been difficult, especially if I had kids. Kids would wonder, what the heck is dad doing telling people his deep secrets? Like I said, I had a reason for doing that. So keeping my boundaries has always been an issue with me. And the doctors have helped me with that. It's been hard for me to shut up because I think I have so much truth that I see in society and in my life. Did I think I'm on a mission to tell? So at any expense, you know, art is the highest. And so I just keep telling it. But I, like I said, now I write fiction. It's not stuff that will I think some of my friends kind of cringed at some of the stuff I told on City Boy and hoped that the cops weren't knocking at their door. I got to be careful because there are laws, there are privacies, there are boundaries that you can't hurt people you're not even realizing you're hurting. So I got to be careful. That's why I chose fiction, because it seems so innocuous.
Right.
You know, somebody says, well, this isn't true anyway, so I can, you know, I can accept it.
You can make it what you want.
Right. You can make it what you want. Yeah.
Right. I want to know is how you currently, you know, you talk about this concept in your story, Changing Ways, about mental health court. And it seems like a concept that's built on fairness and the idea of giving someone a chance when they've done something wrong or against the law. Talk a little bit about how it currently works. Do you have an idea of how it currently works when somebody who's mentally ill commits a crime or does something?
Well, I think most counties now have a mental health court. The Twin Cities does. So you break the law, you have a mental illness, and the psychiatrist that interviews you determines to what extent your mental illness was the cause of you breaking the law. And that's what they did with me, but it wasn't mental health court. It was just, that's why I'm so proud of my judge, that she was ahead of her time. Anyway, now you go before psychiatrists, they probably determine that you couldn't help yourself because of your mental illness. So you go to the mental health court, and they usually have requirements of you. Sometimes it's a commitment to a halfway house or a program. That's what it was for me. Or they have you commit to AA meetings or volunteer job, or they have you, there's some price you got to pay, but you just don't go to the penal system, the prison, or the criminal group home. You kind of taken out of the criminal system and put in the mental health system, so to speak. And you probably are required to take meds. The system is really, really high on medication because they see it works. They see people that were, and that probably is the case with me. They see people that were just totally almost incompetent come back and become responsible citizens. And it's after they take their meds. And so that's really a testimony to the power of those medications they give you. But you can't dwell on that. You have to dwell on your own resources and what you go the direction you think. Thankful for the meds, but realizing it still requires some effort on your part.
In your book, Changing Ways, how did you decide what the rules would be, you know, that the people would have to follow when they're being put in mental health court? Did you go by regular rules like that you know in Minnesota, or did you kind of elaborate on your own idea?
More or less elaborated on my own. I remember when the judge told me she committed me to a halfway house, and I believe I had some other responsibilities. I seen a psychiatrist. I think she recommended AA meetings. She had kind of, so I kind of was going on what had happened in my life before the judge. And, but some of it was just totally fiction, totally what I elaborated on. Because I believe it's, and I believe it's a little bit accurate, you know.
I want to talk about, I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. It's always dangerous when I go on here, but, you know, I want to talk a little bit about people's rights or lack thereof. You know, my belief has always been when one person's rights begin, yours end. I wonder how much of a chance people should be allowed to get. There are certainly some people who do some really horrible things, and it is one thing to be diagnosed as mentally ill, but how far do you go, and how many chances do you give?
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that? Or maybe that's your next book, huh?
Well, it could be. I'm thinking that what they usually do in mental health quarters, it has to be a nonviolent offense. If you use violence, if you kill somebody or assault somebody, they usually don't feel as open to getting you in the mental health court.
Do you feel like that's fair?
I know that people that commit those acts are under tremendous, tremendous pressure to do that. They think God is telling them to do that, a lot of them. And they're really incapacitated. But truthfully, I think there is in everybody a little bit of competency. You have to ask yourself, is this really God's will? You have to be competent enough to understand that God does not generally or ever want you killing somebody else. You have to understand. And if you do that, then you've gone too far. You've wrecked your life. There's some people that thought that my life had gone too far and had no time for them. But thankfully, I still fit within the purview of mental health court. And it wasn't really a mental health court by name, but in all respects, it was the way she handled the courtroom in that time. She felt that I had not gone too far in my offenses to be locked up.
So you were blessed to have that.
I was blessed. I didn't do anything that really hurt anybody, Sam.
Yeah. And that's important.
That is important. The judge sees that, you know, and they're not blind to the fact that, you know, here, I'll tell you what I did. I took off all my clothes on the Skyway. And of course, you can't have people doing that. That's illegal. And it's disruptive, scares people. But she thought.
Sorry to laugh, but.
No.
It comparatively.
The only way to take it. The only way to take it now.
Comparatively serious, it seems like a small offense.
Yeah. You know, and thankfully she saw it that way too. She had to maintain her stature and her dignity of office. So she wasn't laughing about it, but she realized that I didn't really hurt anybody.
Right.
And, you know, so she knew that if I did something like that, it must have been crazy. It wasn't just a streaking thing like the 60s. It was more because I had to do it, you know. And she realized there was something in me that I had to change. And she gave me a chance. And I believe I have been able to change. My last thing I want to do today when I step out the door is take off my clothes in public.
Well, I would think the temperature might stop you a little bit, but yes. So you talk about a little bit about the parallels between one of the main characters in the book, Sarah, who is a female character. I'm wondering what made you choose a female character and what things were different between you and Sarah?
Okay. Primarily the challenge of it. And I've always been for women's rights, and I wanted to make Sarah, kind of a heroine or, she fought a battle in the book, and so did I. And there was that parallel, but she was a woman, and I can't help it. I think there's differences between men and women, the struggles we have. I think they're different. Mm-hmm. And when people say that men and women are the same and they don't draw a distinction between men and women, I think they do a disservice to both men and women. I think there's a difference. And I just wanted to explore that in my own mind when I was writing. I wanted to really find out, you know, what Sarah was really going through. And, you know, I just base my characterization on her and what I see other women going through in society, you know, as much as I know. And just try to put it on paper and make an interesting story out of it.
Well, and I think even for those people who think that there's no difference between men and women, really, that's not completely true. I mean, down to anatomy differences, even, you know, it's all you have to do is look at society and how people treat people, income barriers, things like that.
That's one reason I wrote about a woman is because I'm really sympathetic to the fact that women are not really treated equally to men, and haven't been. It's the men getting all the attention, the men getting all the prizes. And I wanted to make Sarah, as a woman, sharing some victory. And I don't know how women feel about a man trying to help them, but if I was a person getting help, I would want all the help I could get.
Yes, well, I think we all can use that at various times in our life. It sounds like Sarah's relationship with her father paralleled yours similarly. Is that correct? And if so,
correct. You know, she was rebellious and against her father, and I was rebellious. I had two parents. Sarah's got one that's really active in the book. Well, she's got her mother makes an appearance, but it's really between Sarah and her father.
Yes, yes.
And in my life, it was between both my parents, but my dad took the brunt of it. And then when he was gone, somehow my mother and her smart self was able to stop me rebelling against her. And she said, "Why are you biting the hand that feeds you?" And that really hit me. And I said, "Yes, why am I doing that? I realized that you stood in my corner from day one, and you've always been there, even in the psych wards." And I was lucky. I had good parents. And I believe Bill is a good father for Sarah. And, you know, Sarah realizes finally that why are you biting the hand that feeds you?
Were you able to make amends with your father or?
Yes. I think so. It wasn't evolved by the time that he died that we were really even still totally comfortable about each other. Mm-hmm. I think we would be now, but my dad was smart enough to realize that a lot of my rebellion was tied up with my illness, and he never held my illness against me. He never, you know, never judged me for that. He could be judgmental, but he wasn't judgmental for that. And had an amicable time. Mm-hmm. But I still hadn't, you know, children sometimes like to blame their parents. Mm. And so he understood. He just hoped that I wouldn't, hoped I was bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And so by now, yes, I could be really enjoying my father. I wish he was here, but I really could enjoy him now. I see what his plan for me was, and I've tried to live it out, you know, even in his death. But yeah, we were speaking gently to each other by the time he died.
That's good. Yeah. Helps the healing process, I presume.
Yes.
You changed from writing, you know, about yourself to writing fiction. Was that to kind of save your boundaries and?
Yeah. 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 Writing City Boy was very unnerving for me. I mean, especially when I knew people were reading it, I had to develop really thick skin about that.
So in your book, Changing Ways, you have a character called Randall Smith. I believe he's in another book.
Uh-huh. Everyone is a star. Yeah.
Yep. Everyone is a star. And it seems like he's a role model to one of the other main characters, which is Sarah's father. Mm-hmm. And the book goes back and forth to what is a good role model and how much you should take that. And although I don't feel like I had, you know, good role models or people I considered role models that were famous or anything, do you think that that is a good thing? I mean, everyone has a role model or sometimes tries to, right?
Right. I think that what hit me in my life at one point was a boss told me, he said, the world needs stars. And I think we do. And we got to realize that stars are stars. They're not really connected to everyday emotions. They're connected to some higher or some, other dimension where they just draw a tremendous amount of attention on themselves. Mm-hmm. But they do clever things and they can really use their star power to back a cause or mm-hmm. to do good things with it. And I think that a star can be a role model. You know, it's not somebody you would confide in necessarily, but you can admire them for their grit and you can be curious about what makes them tick. Mm-hmm. Why do they have this ability to draw attention onto themselves? You can be interested in that, but there's a danger there that you can put them on such a high pedestal that you fall through for them. And so it's kind of a tricky business to have a role model as a star. I had Bob Dylan and I thought he walked on water and I thought he really cared about me as an individual. And he does to the extent that any human can, but he's got limitations. He wants to make money and he's got his limitations.
Yep.
I began to realize that, but I didn't hold it against him. I thought, no, he's doing the best he can.
And at that time, you must have had the maturity enough to do that. But I think sometimes when people are young and in a certain position, they don't necessarily see
absolutely. I didn't when I was young either. I thought, like I said, I thought Bob Dylan was the cat's meow. I thought he was everything. And sometimes I wonder what we have going with Christ. Christ is far more compassionate than anybody else. But, I wonder if we haven't put him on some kind of impossible pedestal too. At some point, you have to just say, well, what is my life? Where do I fit into this star's life? And how can I assume responsibility and really develop my own talents? And that's where I've been with Dylan, is at some point I had to just draw back and say, hey, you know, Bruce, you want to be a writer too. You can admire Dylan, but you have to pay attention to what your life is. You can't get so absorbed in his that you can't even be a human being.
Do you feel like the relationship between Randall and the judge was unhealthy?
A little bit. And the story with Bill, the judge, is he never really developed that ability to create his own life. He did create it, but his wife often accused him of just leaning on Randall Smith so heavily that he didn't have love for her or Sarah. It can't happen.
Although he stuck in it when she left, so.
Yeah, he did, yes.
I would say, I think everyone has some admiration for somebody. And it's hard. I think those boundary lines can be hard. What do you think Bob Dylan would have thought about Randall Smith?
I think he'd hopefully be amused. You know, I still have this kind of like this feeling about Bob Dylan that I know is humorous side and what he thinks funny. He's quite serious most of the time. He's a very serious guy, but I have this kind of this, and a lot of people have that role Bob Dylan. I don't know what he really thinks about that. I don't think Dylan's trying to be amusing, but I think a lot of people like to know what he thinks is funny. And he doesn't really express that outwardly, but you can kind of get to know him and read through the lines a little bit. And so I'm hoping that if he ever, you know, I'm not being unrealistic. I'm not going to try to, he'll never read Changing Ways. I'm about 99.9% sure of that. There's that one.
You never know.
There's that 1.1% that he might read it.
Never say never.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to destroy my illusions about him totally. I think having a that's why I write fiction, because you got one foot in reality and one foot out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta kind of have your dreams, but you have to still stay in reality.
So what kinds of things, as far as advocacy, do you turn to that have helped you with overcoming your symptoms? Do you feel like you've overcome the symptoms of mental illness, or, you know, is it still in your, you know, forefront that maybe, are you ever nervous about slipping, or are you pretty secure?
Well, I remember the slips I had and what it did to me. I'll always have a healthy fear about that, but I'm on pretty secure ground now, I think. And, I just think that I'm satisfied with my sense of reality. And that's mainly what the psychiatrists look for. Are you able to do your job? Are you able to be happy? Do you feel pleasure? They always ask, are you able to feel pleasure?
Mm-hmm.
And I do. My advocacy is for the fair weather model, which I'm employed through. I want that program. That's my main focus, is because they saved my life. I feel like I want them to be able to save other lives in the same way they saved mine. And so I advocate for that the best I can. I would have been a lot more able to do that if I had gotten that law degree. So that still plagues me that I didn't become a lawyer and couldn't fight these things out in court myself. But aww. I might be able to, yeah. But I might be able to find a lawyer that I can tell him my story and he can take up the charge. You never know. Or I can write about it, Sam. That's right.
That's true. Yeah. So I want to touch on the fair weather model, because you talk about that in your book quite a bit. Talk about what that is.
Well, the fair weather model was started by a guy named George Fairweather in the 1960s. And he believed that if you threw people with a mental illness together in a group and made them accountable to each other, they would actually grow in their stability and in their sanity. You know, leaders would form and followers, and, you know, they would hold each other accountable. They really understood the dangers involved with mental illness. They were aware what a mental health diagnosis meant, and they could support each other. So he created this lodge model where people live in group homes. And I don't live in a group home, but I did for 5 years, and I still rub shoulders at work with people that do. Mm-hmm. And we're just a little more forgiving of that mental health. I think some people, just because they've never been there, don't really understand it. And I don't, at one time I really wanted to change that. I wanted everybody, but that's when I wrote City Boy. But now I'm writing fiction. I don't need people to really understand what's going on in my head. I've more gotten to the point where I want to engender a message of tolerance and a message Now, you can be curious about some earth metals, but they're only going to tell you so much.
Right. Yes. Yes. And there is a flaw, obviously. There is a flaw that happens in that system with Sarah and the house. And it feels to me like it was never like the person who did it. She was falsely accused, right? I mean, I read that correctly. It feels like the person who set her up never paid for, never had a consequence.
Right. You're talking about Bane?
No, the girl who was, but she didn't really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, with the gold watch.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was, she was falsely accused, yes.
And is there, I mean, I presume there's like in any system, there's
that could happen in a sequel. Don't forget that. she might appear because last word Sarah said to her as she was leaving the lodge said, this isn't over yet. So watch, stay tuned. Stay tuned.
All right.
Old old teaser there. Okay.
What do you want people to take away from the book Changing Ways?
Well, you know, I want them to be entertained. I think the worst thing somebody with the mental illness can have is people to take the things they say without a grain of salt, take them at face value, even though sometimes people with the mental illness want people to believe them. I think you have to understand that knowledge that they have is flawed. It's oftentimes delusional, or sometimes it's hateful. Sometimes it's very antisocial. And I want people to be able to see that people with mental illness, I hope I'm not selling all my brothers and sisters, but I'm just saying people with mental illness do have flawed thinking and can't, you know, unless you're an Abraham Lincoln that's just got depression, which is not really creating delusions, you have people that are a little bit unreliable because their mind, for whatever reason, doctors have not been able to figure this out. Nobody's been really able to figure it out, why their minds are telling them lies, but they are. So I want people to just understand that. And I think people with mental illness can take comfort from the fact that nobody is really judging them too harshly for having this flawed thinking. That's what I want. I want to entertain people, but I have a strong message that I want to convey to understanding that people with mental illness have flawed thinking, and we have to understand them as such, but you can't really jump in their face like Bill tries to do sometimes and, call them out on it, because it's really an impossible situation sometimes to untangle that creative, that confused thinking. I think in my case, I've been quite lucky. I've been able to untangle a significant amount of it, to the point that I think I am reliable now and I take responsibility and I am a reliable person. But there's a lot of people in the mental health system that haven't been able to get that far.
I do agree with you. I think that, you know, mental illness, like many things, is a disability, and we're all responsible for dealing with our disability and figuring out how to make it work for us and how to cope in society and to deal reasonably or as reasonably as we can. And it seems like you've come out on the pretty good end of that. And you,
yeah, I've had a lot of help, but I've been able to take it. A lot of people in the mental health system, I try to help some of my coworkers at times kind of have a sense of humor. I mean, some of them have done things that are not humorous and you can't really work that way with them, but there's a lot of people that, you know, like, just have delusions like their hair's, they're bald and they're all caught up with all this aura being bald, and that makes them sick. And I try to get them to understand that's humorous. You know, that is a funny thing. And they don't have to be so damn vain about it. I try to draw out the humor in a situation. That's basically been my lifetime mode, is to make people laugh at themselves, not in a sick way, but in a healthy way, to realize that we have great ambition, but limited abilities. We can only do so much. Disabled in my mind.
I have my thought on that is like, it's easy to joke with somebody with your own disability, but sometimes when someone else comes in and jokes, it is so not the same.
That's right. You know, I would never say anything to you about blindness because I don't know. I don't know what that's like to go through. And I'm very careful even when I deal with clients with mental illness, I'm careful. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say anything that will offend them or throw them off.
So what do you see as your next writing adventure? Do you have an idea yet?
Yeah, I have a book that I'm working on. I'm 100 pages into it or so. It's called The Best of the World. And it's Sarah and a boyfriend who are going to college and going on to law school. And one of them is doing things the old school way with books, notes, and pens and paper, you know, kind of a relic because of a deal they made with each other. And one of them gets to use the gadgets. And so it's kind of this humans versus the machines. And I have really, truthfully, in my own mind, decided who's going to win. Because, of course, I want the old school person to win. It'd be romantic to think that the old school, the humans still have it. But it's not really always what you see out there. And so I haven't figured out how I'm going to be able to handle this yet, but I'm working on it.
How can people get your books?
Amazon.
All right.
Just enter my name, Bruce Ariel, A-R-I-O, Bruce Ariel, all one word. And, my books will come up, and then you can just purchase them online. My email address is arielwriter@centurylink.net, and I will send you a book as well if that's the way you want to do it.
That's very, very good. I wish you the best of luck on your newest book that will be coming out then. Any idea of when, or is it a while?
Well, it's out now.
Well, The Changing Ways is, but the next
newest book. I haven't really set a goal on that yet. I want this book to be the best, live up to its title. And so I'm taking a lot of time with it. I am, there's not one word in there that I haven't thought over a couple times. And that may be an exaggeration. But I'm very detail-oriented that way about my words that I choose. And I really want them to really feel the struggle these two young people have in their life with their illness and with their ambitions and with their love for each other. You know, it's kind of a love story too.
Well, I really have enjoyed our interviews, and I wish you the best in your this book and the one that you'll have coming out at some undefined date. Charlene, I wanted to check to see if you had any questions or if I asked them all.
Bruce, I worked in mental health for many, many years at a VA, and I'm impressed with how you're trying to get out the word that mental illness is part of our society, and there's things that can happen that are in the good light. It's all not negative.
Hey, Char, thank you. It's people like you that have made my life a whole lot easier, because I did not really have that explanation for myself. I had to get that from other people.
Well, thank you, Bruce, again. And is there anything you want to leave us with?
I've always given this advice. You know, people ask me if I have any words of wisdom. Follow your dream. Follow your dream, because if you lose your dreams, you've lost a significant part of your life. I know there are people that have lost their dreams. And I kind of am aware of the poverty that we have in our nation and how difficult it would be to feel you can live out your dream, you know, with your day-to-day not knowing whether you have enough money at the end of the day to eat. I know it's impossible for a lot of people, but there's a lot of us out there that can still live their dream and encourage people to do that and really follow their dream.
Well, thank you again, and I wish you the best.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been my pleasure to talk with you. I am happy that we got together today.
I am too. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI's or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Mason engineered. Thank you, Mason. We were speaking with Bruce Ariel. Bruce is the author of Changing Ways, which is the book we talked about today. But he has many other books, or at least three other books, I believe, and some poetry on Amazon. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. If you'd like to be on my email list, you can email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. And suggestions are welcome, and ideas about the show as well. Fresh Fruit is up next, unless you're listening to this podcast. And in that case, please keep listening to other podcasts that we have. Thanks so much for listening. Good evening. KPI.org.